there's always before marriage a period of engagement, and it's an incredibly important time. The period of engagement is an incredibly important time. The length of it is also important. It mustn't be too short, and it mustn't be too long. A relationship that is not heading towards marriage tends to bog down, goes into limbo, and lots of damage can occur. But one that is too short, where you don't have opportunity to really examine what the relationship is going to be like and examine one another in light of it, can be also dangerous. It should be travelling towards marriage. But it's a lot more than just wedding plans. I think the big worry for me as I see young people is they're all talking about what dress they're going to wear and the flowers and how many people are going to come. And so much time is taken up with an event that lasts no more than a few hours and forgets what the real deal is, a marriage that ought to last a long lifetime. And so it's about thinking rationally about your relationship. What are the main issues that exist between you and the person that's going to get married? And what are the major tensions? You know, how are we going to deal with those areas of doubts and those areas where we find distrust between us? It's not a time, it's not meant to be a time of heavy romance or trial marriage where you move in. You know, even the government has recognised some years ago that those people who sleep together before they get married have a lesser chance of a successful marriage later. You know, God's not an idiot. He made these rules for a very special reason. And so it's a testing time. It's a time where you kind of ask yourself, am I entering into a relationship that will be a blessing to us both, that will be a blessing to children who come to the marriage, that will be a blessing to God, and a blessing to God's plan? When Adam and Eve got together, you know, God called Eve a helper. Now, sometimes the girls find that very hard, but what it suggests very strongly and says very strongly is that they both had stuff to do. Otherwise, he wouldn't need a helper. And so we had things to do. And so it's not just about the couple. It's not just about the couple and their children. You know, it's about the couple, their children, and the impact they'll have in the world around them. And so the question will be, will the marriage have benefits for me? Will it benefit my spouse? Will it benefit my children? Will it benefit the community and ultimately the world and God's plan? Someone once said that before you go into marriage, your eyes should be wide open. But after you're married, it's a good idea to close them a little. Now, you might say, what's this got to do with Exodus? Well, I think it has a lot to do with Exodus. Because, in a sense, God has come to get a wife, his people, the people of Israel. And he's taken them from the enemy, and now he's moving them along in a period of engagement to a place where they will get married. In other words, there will be formal vows made at the rock. And so this is a period of time where they discover each other. Now, God doesn't need any education about the people, but the people need to know about their God. You know, what kind of God is he? Now, what's great about this and why I want to look at the big picture rather than bogging down at the little incidental events is that we see a pattern emerging. And it's important for us to see and understand that pattern. The pattern is this, that the people come to a crisis. Okay? There are seven of these crises. The people come to a crisis and sometimes they complain and sometimes they don't. But whether they complain or not, God acts graciously to look after them. And then he uses the crisis, the experience of the crisis, to teach them about trust and obedience. Now, let me just say that again. The people come to a crisis, that's the first thing. They sometimes complain, they sometimes don't. Then God acts graciously to look after them. Then he uses the experience to teach them trust and obedience. And, of course, he records it so that we can learn something from it as well. So, the appalling loss of life in Egypt made Pharaoh glad to see the end of the Israelites. And so would end 430 years in Egypt. Moses gathered up the bones of Joseph and led the people of Israel out of Egypt. And God went ahead of them day and night. During the day it was a cloud, during night it was a fire. The first crisis or potential crisis that they come to, of course, is the Philistines. And they're, in a sense, blocking their way to the sea. And here's where we see God act. This is God acting as the good shepherd, and he leads them around the Philistines, as we read in Exodus 13, 17 to 18. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though it was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert, rowed towards the sea. And so that ends a potential crisis. God is a good shepherd who looks after his sheep and ensures that he leads them around the danger. But the second crisis is a far greater crisis. Pharaoh again changes his mind. And I guess there are a number of reasons for that. The scriptures tell us that he suddenly realised that he lost a lot of free labour. But also there's the other issue of his own pride. As I've said many times, he really does believe that he has the power to work the gods to ensure that there's harmony in the universe. He really believes that. Anyone who's studied ancient Egyptian religion will see that that's true. And this is a complete challenge to where he believes he sits in relationship to the rest of the cosmos. And so there's a pride issue as well. And he really goes for broke this time. 600 of his best chariots and a whole pile of his not-so-good chariots, together with his whole army, it seems, he goes to get them back. And, of course, the people complain and they lose heart, as we see in verse 11 and 12 of chapter 14. They said to Moses, was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert. And Moses bolsters their courage by saying, do not be afraid. Stand firm and you will see the deliverance of the Lord that he will bring today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You only need to be still. And Moses must have been doing a bit of whinging as well. The text is a little difficult at this point because Exodus 14:15 says, the Lord says to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. And God instructs Moses to lift his staff and open the sea. And God opens the sea and sends a wind. The wind doesn't hold the sea up because they'd never be able to walk through a wind that was strong enough to hold the sea up. The wind was there to dry the land once the sea had moved apart. And so he instructs his staff, he opens the sea, sends the wind to dry the ground, which gives the people what they need. And then, of course, when the Egyptians come, they're all drowned. And they will never again, for several hundred years at least, be a threat to the Israelites again. So the crisis is over and God has come through and a lesson has been learned. The people have learnt something from that, as we read in Exodus 14:31. And when the Israelites saw the great power the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. And his sister Miriam writes a song to celebrate the event. And they even get out their tambourines and dance. Not the sort of thing that Presbyterians or Baptists would do, but nevertheless, they got excited enough to do that. The verse that sums up her song is this one, verse 11 to 13. Who among the gods is like you, O Lord? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders? You stretch out your right hand and the earth swallowed them. In your unfailing love, you will lead the people you have redeemed in your strength. You will guide them to your holy dwelling. And so we have there beautifully expressed what they have learnt for a very short time, that God will finish the job of salvation. He's not the kind of God that would rescue them out of Egypt and then run out of ideas and be unable to bring them home. So that ends the second crisis. The third crisis, 3 days they travel without water and they get thirsty. And then they come across water, but it's bitter. We are told that they grumble against Moses. We're not told exactly what they said. Maybe the language was a bit too rich for a family show or what, I don't know. But we're just told that they grumble against Moses. And Moses cries out to the Lord and was shown a piece of wood which he threw in the water and all the bitterness disappeared. And God again uses this to teach them something. And what he says is this, if you listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all his decrees, I will not bring on you any of the diseases I brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. And then, as a sort of a rest, he takes them off to a little foretaste of paradise, I guess. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs and 70 palm trees, and they camped there near the water. And so ends crisis three, and another lesson from God. If you remain faithful to me, I will look after you, and just as I took the bitterness out of the water, I will heal your sicknesses. Crisis four, they arrive at the desert of Sin, and there's no food. And the people get really nasty at this time. Now, this is a really important event, this one. And the Israelites said, if only we died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into the desert to starve this entire assembly to death. How human that is, isn't it? I don't care about my eternity, just fill my stomach. The great lesson we need to learn is that the farmer feeds the pig not because he loves the pig, but he loves pork. So often we're just happy for what we can get now and we forget the future. But God is not fazed by their whinging and appalling lack of trust, and he uses the event to drive home a very powerful lesson. First of all, he reveals his glory, and then he promised to provide them with food. This is what he says. While Aaron was speaking to the whole Israel community, they looked towards the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud. The Lord said to Moses, I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I, the Lord, am your God. And of course, later on we'll discover they'll complain about the way in which it tastes. They get bored with it. I was reading a book just recently by Hill. It's a story about Fairbridge boys, and I found it interesting because I went to school with a couple of Fairbridge boys. The Fairbridge children were taken from England before, during and after the Second World War, right up until the early 60s. And people believed they were orphans, but in reality they were taken from parents who generally couldn't afford to keep them. And David Hill is writing his experiences. He was one of them. And he was writing his experiences of Fairbridge. And he said the kind of food you got in the evening depended on how good a cook you had in your house. There were 17 houses, and the boys were scattered, and the girls were scattered around these houses. And they said one particular house, Brown House, the woman was a particularly bad cook. And so one night she cooked scrambled eggs, and none of the boys would eat it. It was appalling, apparently. They wouldn't touch it. And so she runs off to the boss and says, look, you know, my boys are not eating my food. Come down here and order them to eat. And he was taking his dog for a walk at the time, so he comes down to the house, and he brings his dog, and he sees the food. Now, if he'd been half decent, he would have tasted it himself. But rather than that, he puts it on the floor, and he said, if the dog eats it, you've got to eat it. Well, thankfully for the boys, even the dogs refused to eat it. And so he turned to the woman, he said, I think you better fry some eggs and put it on toast. Maybe they'll eat that. But anyway, the thing is that they complained about that as well. But this is an enormously powerful lesson for them. The first question I suppose we need to ask is, what was the manna? And again, you get all these people trying to come up with naturalistic explanations for it, and none of them work. It's described there in 1631. The people of Israel called the bread manna. It was white, like coriander seed, and tasted like wafers made with honey. Now, there's nothing in the desert that even resembles that, except the coriander seed. It looks a bit like it, but it certainly doesn't taste like it. And what's interesting about it is you could boil and bake it, which was what they were advised to do on the night before the Sabbath, so that they could preserve it for the day of the Sabbath. But this substance, which you could boil and bake, if you left it in the sun, it dissolved and disappeared. So it was really a supernatural bread of some sort. And of course, what it does is it points to Jesus. And Jesus picks up this theme in himself. He said, Moses gave you manna in the desert, but I am the true bread of life. And so just as you've got supernatural bread to keep you alive on earth, I'm the one that if you eat of me, I will give you eternal life. And so this points to Jesus. And we're told that they got all as much as they needed. So those who collected too much didn't have too much. And those who didn't have enough, those who collected little also had enough. But the food was to be a constant lesson in obedience and trust, and an opportunity for every single individual Israelite to display his faith. Now, first of all, of course, they were not to store it overnight. If they did that, it would turn into maggots. And of course, there were some who did it, and they got maggots the next morning. In other words, they had to show that they were prepared to trust God to provide their needs each day as they needed it. Now, the only time they were allowed to store it was on the night before the Sabbath, and that was so that they could trust God to provide that extra they needed so that they could rest on the Sabbath. And so every single member of the community had an opportunity to express their faith. And that hasn't changed, has it? And do you trust God to provide what you need? I mean, you think about the Sabbath. Can you afford to rest one day a week? Or are you afraid that if you don't keep doing whatever job you have, now I know some people don't have a choice because of shift work and that, but if you're just working that extra day because you don't trust him, then you're not being faithful. Does God provide your needs? And would it not be better to spend the Sabbath resting with God's people? That's the question you need to ask. Now, you can kind of opt out of it with all kinds of arguments, but at the end it comes down to whether you trust God or not. It hasn't changed. Every single one of us have an opportunity to express our faith in simple ways like that. So that's the end of that crisis. The fifth crisis was that there was no water in the desert of Sin. People were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?" And Moses comes to the Lord with a panic. He says, "They're about to stone me." And so God says, "Take the elders and walk ahead of them to Mount Horeb." Very appropriate, in a sense. You know, the mountain that will provide the living water. He goes to Mount Horeb. He says, "Strike the stone and the water will flow." And so ends crisis 5. At crisis 6, the Amalekites attack the Israelites. And God steps in again. And he acts through Moses. And Moses is told to stand on the hill and hold up the staff. And while everybody's holding up the staff, they have strength against the Amalekites. They're in the ascendancy. But the moment the staff starts to drop, they start losing. And so Aaron and Hur keep it up for him. And while ever the staff is up there, they win until finally they destroy the Amalekites. And it's a great lesson for us to recognise that. We're not all in the front. We're not all the fighters. Not everyone is out there preaching the gospel. But we do need prayer support. And it's real. You know, Tuesday morning, for example, a whole army of people here in Camden go out to preach the gospel to children in our schools. Children just like the ones we saw just down there then. Now, I'm sure that all of you would like every one of those children to be with you in heaven. Is that right? Does anyone don't want one of their kids in heaven? Anyone? I mean, there are times, aren't there? Okay, but we know they'll be better up there. And so there's lots of other kids out there too that need to hear. Now, not everyone can do it, but the thing is, we need the prayer support. I think it'd be wonderful for people to pray on Tuesday morning. And there's another one on Thursday morning. And there's a couple of us that preach the gospel over at Leppington on Friday morning, and there's people who are doing work in the hospitals and in the nursing homes, and there's just you guys who get opportunities from time to time to share the gospel with people at work or your friends or your neighbours. We need prayer, and prayer works. God answers prayer. He empowers his fighters with prayer. Crisis number 7 is the administration of justice. Moses trying to hear every single case that comes to him, every little argument coming to Moses. And so God sends Jethro, his father-in-law, to talk to him about it. And he said, "Moses, you can't possibly keep this up. You'll wear yourself out. And so what you need to do is set up a hierarchy of courts so that you can have a nice low court to deal with the very simple matters, and then you could deal with the very, very serious matters." And, of course, every government in the world now has a system of hierarchy of courts based on that kind of process. So what have we learned from all of this? As we see this, the first thing is, of course, that God can be trusted to care for his nation. He is a good shepherd who leads his people around danger. He can be trusted to act for them in judgment against their enemies, as he did the Egyptians. And also we need to understand that though he doesn't do it very often, he doesn't invade his own physical laws very often. They're quite rare things, miracles. But if needs be, happy. He is prepared to do anything that he needs to do with the universe he created in order to exercise that judgment, as he did in the case of the Egyptians. He can give them success at war, and we're reminded that Moses was told to write this event down, the Battle of Rephidim, write it down so that when Joshua goes into the Promised Land, he'll remember this and remember how a battle is supposed to be won. He can provide their food and water. He can protect them from disease. And he can also create a just and efficient society within them. And so the question that we have to ask ourselves, this is a really serious question. So the question you have to ask, does God love you? Is God dedicated to you? They're very important questions. Is he intelligent enough to know what you need? Is he powerful enough to supply it? Does he know what is best for you, not only in the long run, but does he know what's best for you today? Does he have your best interests at heart? Are you likely to improve your situation by disobeying God? Are you likely to make things better for yourself? Are you likely to give yourself a more meaningful life by disobeying him? Would it be a happier life? You know, what are you prepared to throw away for what you can get in the present? Do you think you'll improve your chances by whinging and demanding your rights with God? I was just talking this week to a friend of mine that I hadn't seen for quite some time, and she said, what are you preaching on down there in Camden? I said, oh, we're just working our way through Exodus. She said, oh, that's fabulous. She said, I was converted by reading Exodus. And I said, how did that happen, Sue? She said, well, when I read the Exodus, I realised I would have killed a lot of them if I'd have been God. So he must be an incredibly patient God. You know, but we have to be careful. That's why I want to see the big picture. You know, a lot of things that he tolerated on the way to the mountains, he didn't tolerate after. Because at the mountain, they made promises. You know, the wedding vows, as it were exchanged. And this is incredibly important. He takes your promises seriously and expects you to keep them. You know, one of the worst pieces of doctrine I've ever heard is the thing that says, well, you know, I know this fella, he went forward when he was 10, and God will honour that promise. He'll only honour that promise if you keep it. If you make a promise, he knows you're intelligent enough to know what you're saying, and you're expected to keep it. So what he tolerates on the way to the mountain is he will not tolerate after. And so when they start grumbling and complaining, they are severely punished. And the ultimate punishment for all of them, of course, is that they get excluded, except for Caleb and Joshua. And even Moses, and here's a lesson for all church leaders, including myself, you don't have the right to get angry on behalf of God. He'll choose when he's angry and not. You don't have the right to do it. And so God is serious with people who go into relationship with their eyes open with him. He's serious about that. The other thing is, of course, when he first brought them out of Egypt, they were like children. But they were meant to grow up. And that's the same for us. You know, I remember one of my daughters, I won't say which one of them, but one of my daughters was always whinging and complaining about having to do the washing up. Isn't that an odd thing to do, you know? Now, I tolerated that at 10, and I tolerated it at 14. I even put up with it at 17. But one day she did it when she was 19, and I said, it's time you moved out. It's time you moved out and got yourself a flat. Then you've got no one to argue with about the washing up. You see? What we may tolerate with our children, we will not tolerate when they're grown up. And that's the way God operates as well. And the writer of Hebrews, who understood this beautifully, you know, he said, I would write to you deep and meaningful things, but you're still children. You're still carrying on like spoilt little brats. And so all I can do is keep giving you milk. And I tell you, you keep feeding people milk and they will not grow. And the writer of Hebrews also says, if that's all you want, you might as well leave and stay out. Because the next time you see God, You won't see him as a father who welcomes you, but you'll see him as a very angry judge. And why is he angry? He's angry because he knows you're intelligent enough to understand him if you take the trouble, and that he expects you to obey the things he teaches you. He doesn't give you more than you can possibly bear. And so we have to take him seriously. You know, the person in hell has one consolation, and that is that God loved him enough to be angry with him. And that's true for every single human being. And so we've all got to grow up and stop whinging and doing that kind of stuff. You know, you have to ask an incredibly important question here. Can you win an argument with God? Is it likely that you could be right and he was wrong? Or even worse still, you know, for me, I could probably bear that, but I couldn't stand the thought that you could be right and God wrong. And when you think of it, do you really want that to happen? Would you like a God who could be wrong? Could you follow a God that could be wrong? I mean, if he's wrong once, as I said to some JWs the other day, you've been wrong in the past, why should I believe you now? If he gets one thing wrong, brothers and sisters, one thing wrong, he forfeits the right to be God. So you need to ask the big question, and I constantly ask this one at funerals. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And so, if you want to argue with God, you've got to ask a number of questions. The first one, who's going to come back for you when you die? Who loves you enough to come back for you when you die? You know, Walt Disney's had his head frozen with the hope that somebody will come back and unthaw it and attach it to another body. I'm not sure that anyone will bother wanting to do that. I mean, if you look at the stuff he produced, I don't want to go back and raise him from the dead again. Who does love you enough to want to come back for you? It's Jesus. And who has the power to give you back your life that you've lost? It is Jesus. And who knows the way to the Father? It is Jesus. And who will guarantee for you that when you meet the Father, you will meet him as a loving Father with his arms wide open, wanting to welcome you into his home? It is Jesus. But here's a more sober question. Who is going to be handing out the crowns at the end of your life? And will you accept the crown with tears and joy, recognizing that your struggles and your suffering for God has been recognized by Jesus? All of those times you tried hard and it failed. All of those times you were misunderstood even by Christians. All of those times where you beat yourself up trying to get things right and nobody saw you do it. Is that what you want Jesus to be able to say to you? Or will you feel a little guilty that you wasted so much of your life and your opportunities and complain so much because you couldn't trust him and you didn't think it was necessary to obey him?